she was once like me.
With your boy, you're big galoot, you're nincompoop. What's wrong with you? You can't compete. Don't fix your lips to tell me you can. Standing on the bully playing push a man. What you got to do with yourself? Can't you be somebody else? Look at you, described to a T. You're a fool of many in society. I know some more, I shall go on and continue in the song. Fool be fool. The girl I talk to, she's sort of neurotic. Her crazy ex-boyfriend is really psychotic. Scares the girl by threatening her life. Says, girl, you're dead if you're not my wife. Beats her in public, beats her in private. Tried it round me, almost a riot. Said, forget him, don't you know he's a loser? Who would love a woman, turn around and abuse her? Only a fool, as described by the tribe. Here's another one who's on the fool vibe. Gonna make it short, gonna make it quick. But this situation makes me sick. See your brother man with the female. His crazy ego trying to show he'll prevail. In any situation, lady luck's on his side. Emotions run free, nothing he will hide. Well, I remember one sunny day, took my cousin to the park so we can play. On the way, a couple resembled the one I just described, everything assembled. Another young man walked in their direction, bumped him a bit, excuses imperfection. But the man with the lady grabbed the other by the neck, demanded an apology and also respect. The young man aggravated, grabbed him back and smacked him. The girl just laughed and laughed and laughed at him. He felt ashamed for what he had done and looked like a fool to everyone. These are three stories from the naked city. Reality is sometimes a ditty, like Rob Zilla from the Twilight Zone. Earth to your brain, is anyone home? I see you there, try to make amends, try to make some friends, but now my story ends. On the note that I just wrote, stay afloat on the reality boat. Slow down and think and take it cool, and try to avoid the description of them.
We'll be right back. Welcome to the F Word on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. That was A Good Man is Hard to Find and Description of a Fool by A Tribe Called Quest. And did we play that third song as well? No. Okay, great. Good morning. We are waking up here at the F Word, and we're glad that you're listening. We're going to be with you for the next hour. My name's Nicole Deegan. I'm here with Amanda Chalmers and Amy Rappaport, who's doing our technical work for us this morning. Alana is off camping, so she's not in with us this morning. We are all members of the F Word Collective. We're committed to creating and facilitating feminist discussion and debate, plus promoting feminist projects and organizations. We always appreciate suggestions and feedback, so please do, actually, don't call into the studio today, because we've got a guest on the line. I was just going to say, please do call in. No, don't call in. But if you had something to say to us, please do write us at feminisms@gmail.com. We very much welcome feedback and suggestions. We have a couple of announcements to make before we start our show, and we've got a really interesting show today on men and feminism. And on the line, we have Martin Dufresne from Montreal. I think he's living in Montreal still. And we're going to be speaking with him in a few minutes, and he's going to be joining us for a discussion for the whole hour. And to start off with announcements, Antigone Magazine is having a summer subscription drive, and a one-year subscription to their magazine is only $12. They are a semi-annual, nonpartisan magazine about women in politics written by young women in Canada. And the primary goal of their magazine is to encourage young women and men to see women as leaders within Canadian society, as well as to encourage women to engage politically within their communities, their country, and their world. They pride themselves in being a magazine about women politics, women in politics, and the politics of being a woman, and have interviewed women from all political parties, including former Prime Minister Kim Campbell and Green Party leader Elizabeth May. You can check out their blog at antigonemagazine.blogspot.com. You can send questions about subscriptions to antigonemagazine@hotmail.com. And you spell Antigone A-N-T-I-G-O-N-E. Also, Amnesty International and Integral Media are presenting a premiere screening of Towards the Day We Are All Free, which is a 90-minute documentary with First Nations and refugee women that will include a discussion following the screening. It's wheelchair accessible and will be showing at Pacific Cinematheque on Tuesday, August 26th at 7 p.m. The doors are at 6:30 and the tickets are $5 to $7. If you want more information, you can email them at towardstheday@yahoo.com.
All right, thank you, Nicole. So in 1861, John Stuart Mill wrote an essay, The Subjection of Women, in which he thoughtfully laid out the argument that women's treatment under the law was an undeniable injustice, and that the lack of social, political, and economic rights and freedoms afforded to women of his day amounted to a morally and philosophically indefensible state of affairs. This essay, probably one of the earliest and most significant feminist arguments written by a well-known male philosopher, created quite a controversy. Most of Mill's male contemporaries denounced it as ill-conceived and foolish, for it did indeed represent a marked departure from their deeply held misogynistic views, and it constituted a direct and powerful challenge to their patriarchal privilege. Of course, feminist activists of the day, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, applauded, probably shocked to hear such enlightened politics espoused by a man. Unfortunately, Mill's feminist thought came well before its time. The women's movement proceeded over the next century as a distinctly female struggle, with a male presence largely absent, especially in the public face of feminism. It wasn't until the 1970s that Western culture began to experience a reemergence of male feminist thought. A new political movement developed with the aim of actively involving men in ending sexism and violence against women. Male activists began to engage with women's organizations, wanting to listen to women's voices and to learn from their experiences. They also began to develop strategies of their own, ideas they could take back into their work with other men to try to reduce the antagonistic, defensive, and reactionary relationship that most men had with feminism. Men began to challenge themselves and each other to confront and eliminate their own sexism, to recognize the unearned privileges and unfair advantages of patriarchy, to renounce inequality and discriminatory power structures, and to examine the very nature of masculinity itself, to rethink what it means to be a man. This redefinition of male identity, they understood, would not only free women of the damaging effects of living alongside a gender rooted in violence and misogyny, but would also help heal the psychic harm that such an identity has caused for men themselves. Through movements and organizations like the White Ribbon Campaign, an international pro-feminist men's movement founded in Canada in 1991, male activists have begun to dedicate themselves to eradicating male violence by directly involving men in organizing for positive social change, as well as personal transformation to end sexism in all its forms. Even despite the last three decades of male involvement in feminism, still today people have very different opinions about men's place in the women's movement. So we wanted to examine that topic here at the F Word. So today we'll be talking about men and feminism, and we also have a guest here to join us in the discussion.
Hello, Martin, are you?
I'm there.
You can hear us. Hi, good morning and good afternoon to you.
Well, it's almost afternoon here, but thank you. Yes, good morning to you too.
Oh, that's right, it's 11 there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry. I knew that. I just kept thinking it was 12 o'clock. I don't know why. Wishing it was 12 when I got up or something. To start out, can you tell us a little bit about your work? Now, you were involved with Montreal Men Against Sexism for a long time, I believe.
Yes, the group was put together in 1979. When some men decided to try and confront other men about the role of pornography in rape attitudes. So a few men met at a conference. It was a government-organized conference. There were about 250 women and 10 men. And the men who were there said, how come there's so few of us, and what can we do about it? So the group was created then, and I joined it a year later. And it went on until the late 90s, basically, doing essentially awareness raising and doing logistical support for feminist groups, researching gender identity in men, and trying to make sense essentially of why men were such moral cretins, you know. And we were realistic about that, but there were a lot of pushing and pulling at first, because a lot of men in the group, actually a minority of men, but a very vocal minority, insisted that we see men as oppressed by sexism, that we focus our work on what we could do for men, how we could make men make men's lot better. And because that's a problem in general with the men's movement, we can get into that a bit further later on.
Yeah.
But there's quite a pull towards what's in it for me, you know, for redefining masculinity in a way that that absolves it of feminist criticism and that allows men to pursue a very libertarian, liberal perspective where men essentially try to avoid child support, for instance, or paint themselves as aggrieved by feminist analysis. And our perspective was clearly pro-feminist. We acknowledged the problems raised by feminists and could actually testify to them in our own lives. So we decided to organize on the basis of a radical feminist analysis of gender and sexism as dominance, as power over, which brought us into schools, brought us into demonstrations, brought us to raise money and support through letters to the editors and speak outs, feminist analysis and activism on issues of violence, of depictions of women in society, and the whole gamut of out-and-out sexism.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Fantastic. I know I've heard about the work of that organization for many years, and have heard good things, definitely. So can you tell us a little bit, just back even a little further, to how you yourself discovered feminism in your own life?
My very first experience supporting feminism was being asked to star in take a small role in a video about abortion. The first feminist video that was done in Quebec was done in 1973. It was about a woman trying to seek abortion because she'd fallen pregnant, and I was asked to play the role of the dastardly boyfriend who wouldn't put a condom. And I found that it was no problem at all improvising the lines and the dialogue, because as a male, I was right into that perspective of thinking of my self-interest and resisting a call to use contraception. a few years later, I was writing television for CBC, and I decided to write about women in madness and women in violence. And then I essentially discovered feminist analysis through Phyllis Jessler, Andrea Dworkin, and Susan Brown Miller, and French materialist writers. At that time, I was also in love with a strong feminist. I think that's probably what was the strongest factor in my turning over to a more activist role than simply throwing my opinions out in the world, which men tend to do without knowing much about what they're talking about. As I was researching women, I found out about men. I found out about men's position in gender struggle, and that was quite an eye-opener. I actually stopped writing the TV series because it was so naive about what I was writing about, and I was finding out so much fascinating insights in the women I was reading that I felt it was more crucial to actually try to change the state of things than to write clever TV programs about it.
Ah, hear, hear. Yeah. So is that, like, your... just the way that you've kind of been informed a bit by radical feminism and by listening to, you know, women's analysis, like, is that part of why you define yourself as pro-feminist, or do you ever call yourself a feminist or a feminist ally, or what language do you use to describe yourself?
Well, ally is a good word. I think the key factor in pro-feminism is accountability. I think that's the main sticking point for most men, actually, because they do not want to take direction from women, which is very sad, because I think anti-racist activists have no problem taking, or should have no problem, certainly have no theoretical objection to taking direction from the oppressed. But when it comes to gender, men seem to feel they're entitled to define gender politics by their own as men, and that's a big problem. I define myself as pro-feminist and certainly as an ally that tries to be accountable as much as I can, but I've seen some anti-feminists claim to be feminists just to essentially put their own spin on whatever happens, and male authority, the male voice still has so much authority in society that it's very easy for a man to take the ball and run with it and not be accountable to women in what he does. And that's been a problem. I know that some strong pro-feminists choose to call themselves feminists, and they do a good job at it because they are accountable and they feel that saying one is a feminist makes a stronger statement than simply saying one is pro-feminist. But that's not my position. My position is, by saying pro-feminist, to make it very clear that it is women that are entitled to run the women's movement, and they are the ones who are doing it. They are the ones who are doing 99% of the work, and that's certainly significant. I think that the first thing to say about male feminism is that it's a great concept, but men are not rushing to it. There's very few men that there's very few men that are actually doing the work. A lot of mouths being shut off, but very little work being done. So
yeah,
there's an active resistance by men to feminism, which is a much stronger issue than the few and far between men who actually are supportive and are helpful on the ground.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I think when I was thinking about that question and about if a man defined himself as a feminist or as an ally or as pro-feminist, and I kind of thought, you know, as long as he recognizes that there's sexism and cares to work to end oppressions and cares to look at his own role and to, you know, like, be a conscientious person who agrees with the same kind of perspectives I do, I'm excited as all heck. I don't really care what he calls himself. I mean, not that I don't think language is important. I do, but in some ways, like, I know for me, like, I get so feeling so desperate for anybody who just agrees with me. I'm like, oh great, fantastic, you're a bunch of men, that's great, I don't mind. Like, anyone who agrees, that's good.
but will he agree? That's what happens on the ground, in the front lines. A lot of men claim entitlement to be part of the movement against sexism, and then they tend to center whatever is being said or done on not only on their own issues but on their style, and their style is still one of overpowering women, is still one of centering whatever is discussed on their own issues.
Absolutely, yeah. And when I'm saying that, I mean, I'm being kind of flip, but in mm-hmm. reality, I mean, I was just talking to the other members of the F-Word Collective the other day about how I was at a meeting on prostitution issues, and that the three men that were in the room ended up totally dominating the conversation once the discussion period came in, and really loud voices really overtaking the conversation, going on and on at length. And I thought it was just an interesting little observation in gender relationships, and I think that that does really tend to happen, and I think that it's very easy for all of us to fall into those roles of the women being more silent and more receptive and men taking up a lot more space. And the other situation I wanted to talk about like that was when I used to work in a transition house where we actually had a male employee there. And at that time, it was, I guess, when he was originally hired, which was before I was there, it was considered this really progressive idea to have a man working within the transition house. And of course, what ended up happening is he ended up dividing all the women into basically two camps, and he his work was valued more than anybody else's. His name became bigger than the rest of ours. He got credit for certainly most of the work that I did, and it became this really conflictual, uncomfortable situation, and a lot of the women in the shelter related to him either in a flirtatious way or else they were afraid of him, and it just took up a ton of space.
Yeah,
and became really divisive, and it was it made me extremely hesitant about where one should put those boundaries around men's involvement. Like, yes, I feel very welcoming toward men, but I wouldn't say that I feel like the right place for a man would be in a transition house or in a women's center, or like, I think that there's a place for that connection and that alliance. And mm-hmm. that of course is an issue of great controversy.
Yes. Unfortunately, men work from that position of entitlement, and one quickly loses sight of the basic criterion. Is it more trouble than they're worth, you know? Do men's work, do men's voice, do the fact that men's voice carry more than women authority in this society, is that a plus, that men take up issues and become spokespersons for a movement more easily? I've seen this happen a lot. A lot of mixed groups end up having leaders and spokespersons that are male, even if the issue is fighting sexism, because of the opportunism of using male authority in communications, and because so many people very much want men to join women in the movement to end sexism.
Mm-hmm.
Men, there's a lot of men taking advantage of that need, and that's unfortunate because women are marginalized, and the divisiveness that you mentioned is also a factor. I think that heterosexuality plays into it a lot, and other issues to rapport with authority and rapport with fathers, and it's quite a mess, and unfortunately men do not seem attuned to it. They're not very into understanding those dynamics and working to solve them, for instance by taking purely logistical roles and staying away from leadership positions.
Yeah. And maybe that's like a key piece right there too, is like in terms of sorting out men's involvement in activism, in feminist groups, in feminist activism, is what the roles are and making sure that it's clear what those roles are.
Yeah. Also, another thing that gets swept under the rug real rapidly is men's actual position in gender dynamics, in sexism. Male feminism sort of asks us to take for granted that men will be part of the solution, and that's sort of dancing around the elephant, that they're the problem, that their power, their tactics, their the way they come on to women is very much part of the problem of sexism. And men hate generalizations about men that are not supportive of them, just as whites hate generalizations about whites when one looks at racist issues. So that's a problem, and that to work with men sort of almost beckons women to forget about sexism and to see men as a great boon to women, because they're ready to say the right thing sometimes, and that sort of gets people away from the very real behavior of not only all those men out there, but even the men inside the women's movement. I've seen very complex and heartbreaking situations in Montreal when, for instance, among anarchists, questions of rape came up and questions of sexual harassment came up, and not only were the men defensive, but a lot of the women were defensive to these issues being brought out clearly, because relationships were at stake, the mixed character of the movement was at stake. There's always a lot of hardship around the issue of whether a group will be open to men or not, and it's a lot of trouble. It's a lot of division and a lot of suffering, and a lot of women are silenced too. I think lesbians are silenced when men are touted as the great white hope, you know, the solution to this division of the genders, and this division is created and enforced by men basically. Yeah. So that one can lose sight of that. But still, there is hope.
Having said all that, to sum up, there is hope. That's some very astute points there, and we're going to take a quick break. Okay. So we are listening to, or we are listening to, you're listening to The F Word on CFRO 102.7 FM. We're speaking with Martin Dufresne on the phone from Montreal. Are you in Montreal, Martin?
Actually, I'm lucky enough to be outside of the city and by a lake, so it's a wonderful day here. And I'm just out of the water right now, so I'm 50 kilometers north of Montreal.
Nice. Okay, great. And we're going to play a song, take a quick break, and then we'll be back to speak with Martin.
Okay.
Radioactive, a co-op radio fundraiser. Featuring burlesque, circus aerials, choir, African dance, jazz, comedy, and then dance your butts off to Blackberry Wood and Nessa V, bringing you hip-hop, R&B, and Brazilian sounds.
Tickets, only $10 at High Life Records on the Drive, Little Sisters on Davie, or Burgess Angels on Main of Broadway. It's Radioactive.
Saturday, August the 30th at the Wise Hall. ADNAC at Victoria Drive. 7:30 p.m. are the doors. Show is at 8 p.m. Hosted by David C. Jones. Come on down and help support community radio with Radioactive.
Women, and do you know what about your sex risk?
All right. So that was Propagandi, Refusing to Be a Man. And you are listening to The F-Word on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. I'm Amanda, and I'm here with my F-Word collective sisters, Amy and Nicole, and we are speaking to Martin Dufresne on the phone. Martin, you have made a couple of really interesting, I think, and really important observations about male involvement in feminism. Largely, you know, talked about the sort of defensiveness that a lot of men feel, I think, or their fear of being blamed for the behavior of other men and their reluctance to sort of examine their own behavior and I guess an inability to sort of recognize that feminist consciousness is a process. It's not something that, you know, you can just state that you're a feminist and then that ultimately just automatically makes you a feminist, that it is something that must develop over time, and it requires a sort of constant reevaluation of one's behavior and one's feelings and thoughts and attitudes towards women, and brought up the idea of accountability, which is, I think, really important. And you're right that it often does get very overlooked by men because they sort of expect a sort of type of congratulation because they've, you know, they're doing some sort of work that's involved.
And I think they get it too. I think it's easy for women to fall into giving that congratulation and really reacting in a big way because, out of whatever, maybe relief or...
Yeah, and I mean, because a lot of us are just very, I guess, not used to having men that are even in voice supportive of what we're doing, let alone, you know, wanting to become involved. So we tend to let things slide or overlook maybe some more subtle forms of sexism.
And some not very subtle at all.
Yes, yes, it's true.
I think men are trying to protect privilege and identity. I think that's one of the main problems we had in the group at first. That is that to acknowledge that men were behaving as dominants, as self-interested people trying to protect their power over other people, was to challenge our own identity as good guys, which most men tend to run to. So to protect identity you see a lot of the men's movement, for instance, claim pro-feminism, but essentially try to rebuild masculinity as an essential positive, which of course is sexist, because if it's great to be a man, that implies that it's not so great to be a woman. When males hog qualities as being essential maleness, and this you get a lot of that in the mythopoetic men's movement, but also in the more general liberal hoopla about the new man or the very visible media-driven image of the man as the solution to sexism, all these qualities that are being claimed as masculine are essentially implicitly refuse to women who are being pushed back into the stereotype. So that's why a lot of the work we did was to research and to expose the so-called men's movement. One of the most fascinating books we read early then was Barbara Ehrenreich. She wrote a book called The Hearts of Men in 1983, and it was called The American Dream and the Flight from Commitment. And what she did was look at how men had been dealing with the women's movement and with feminist consciousness in general over the last 15 years. And she sort of illustrated the great hope of seeing men rise up against sexism as being harmful to them. And she came to this from a socialist feminist perspective, where comradeship and unity against oppression were the key word, really. And it's interesting because she failed. She failed to find in the men's movement this supportive attitude and this commitment to changing sexism that she had hoped to find. What she found was, she encapsulated it as the voyeur in the supermarket. That is, men rushing to a greening of America, to a new set of attitudes which made them look cool and which centered on their self-interest, of course, which allowed them to pick and choose the offerings the new system offered them. Yes, they could now be warm and kind to children, but that didn't bring them to work against the economic oppression of women, for instance. And that's something I've noticed among pro-feminist men, is that we're gung-ho on issues of violence, but we strangely fall silent when the issue becomes how women are being screwed economically, and how oppression remains a big issue in around salaries and social entitlements. That's something that I still have to find out. Why is there so much interest in men on issues such as abortion, for instance, which allows men to have easier sexual access to women, but very little support when it comes to women growing old without pensions and falling into deep poverty and homelessness among women. You see almost no men on these issues.
Martin, I have a question. I was just reading an article involving men in gender policy and practice, written by Michael Flood, and he outlines, he sort of summarizes four main reasons why men should engage in feminist politics. And one of them, he says, that men have a stake in fostering gender equality. So there's growing recognition that gender inequality is an issue that not only affects women, but affects men too. I'm just wondering what you think of that. I had sort of an intense reaction when I read that, because I was thinking, does it really affect men negatively, like in a really negative way? And do men have a stake in that sense?
Well, there's a liberal and a radical perspective, and Flood exemplifies the liberal perspective. So do people like Kaufman or Kimmel, for instance. And that perspective does try to build up for men the advantages of fighting gender oppression. But of course, gender oppression benefits men. From the start, it's a way to accrue privilege, to get sex, to get more money, to get more power in society. And the denial of that is very reassuring. And to bring men to put human values above self-interested material values is certainly a positive project. But it shouldn't take us to the point where we're denying. And I don't think Flood denies them, but he puts the focus on the advantages of supporting liberation for men. But the rich have not been at the forefront of the struggle to abolish class oppression, and whites have not really been on the forefront, although they've been very visible, of the struggle to abolish racism. So I think that we're going to have to be dealing with an anti-feminist men's movement a lot more than we will find supportive men in feminist ranks. And in a way, it's a good thing, because it keeps the issues on the front burner, the issues of oppression, of privilege, of violence, of male gender identity as being that of an oppressor. I think that's there's always a choice to be done between liberalism and radicalism. And the way I've found guidance in is, or first, the women whose words ring true to me, and if they ring true, it's because they ring true to my experience. My experience has been growing up male, growing up an oppressor on the issue of gender, and I'm still very much one. So I think this is why a radical perspective is more truthful for me. And although I work with liberals, and certainly they need to be in the picture, they need to be there, because a lot of young men do not identify as oppressors. They don't understand that at first that what they do naturally can be very harmful and very unfair. So it's a way of bringing them to keep alive an empathy connection to their sisters and mothers and the women they're not in sexual relationships with.
I think the process of white guilt, these words that people talk about, white people moving when they acknowledge their own racism, would be quite similar, quite parallel to the experience of, in a sense, male guilt, moving through that process of remorse and actually identifying as the oppressor.
There's very little guilt among whites and very little guilt among males.
Sometimes that's true.
The word guilt is even used to parody the kind of consciousness men stay away from. Oh, I don't want to feel guilty. Well, you know, you wouldn't be feeling guilty if you were against what we're talking about rather than implicitly for it.
That's true.
But the notion of being guilty is used as a bugaboo, you know.
Yeah, certainly defensive, but maybe without the real basis of guilt, because they're not really willing to recognize their own sexism in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But I mean, as you yourself mentioned, I mean, the type of radical feminism that you embrace is not embraced by a lot of men, and I think that's really where some of the liberal pro-feminist men's movement activities can at least as a first step towards bringing men closer to a feminist consciousness really plays a big role. Sometimes we do need to sort of appeal to people's self-interest, and so these discussions by people like Kaufman about how sexism is harmful for men, I think maybe is a way of just sort of I guess popularizing the movement or bringing young men especially into the beginnings of a feminist consciousness.
Possibly. There's also altruism. I mean, a lot of what I see from people in various social movements is based on altruism, on the common good, mm-hmm. on solidarity with people and the pleasure of working for as a collective rather than strictly on self-interested basis.
Right.
So this is also valid. I was listening to Noam Chomsky on the web yesterday. Mm-hmm. He has a very interesting interview where he discusses pornography and how he ended up being interviewed by somebody who for Hustler magazine. He didn't know it was for Hustler, and Hustler made a big deal of putting him on the front page, and he was quite peeved because he doesn't support pornography at all, and he felt he'd been hoodwinked. But the words he said about pornography did not appeal to a radical feminist analysis. He essentially said it's quite clear when you look at pornography that this is degradation of women, and he wants no truck with it, you know. So that's simple enough. It doesn't have to go through a big process of identifying with radicalism. It's just a matter of not wanting to be part of a system that oppresses other people, that degrades them, not incidentally, but basically, centrally, which is what pornography does, in his words.
Mm-hmm. I think that in my own experience with men, a lot of guys that I've known, when they've try to kind of wrap their brains around feminism and knowing me and like in conversations with me, one of the things that's come up is their own, I think they refer back to their own personal experience of struggling in their own life, mm-hmm. and that rather than using that as a point of empathy to connect with other struggles, they use it more as like, well, no, my life hasn't been great because I'm a man and I've struggled with, you know, this and this and this in life, and I didn't get to do this and this and this in life, and women get to do this and this that I don't get to do because I'm a man, and that that really comes up for them when they're trying to see it, like they see their own, which I guess is part of that same self-interest you're talking about, but that's I guess I'm just reflecting on what I've seen men go through when they're trying to negotiate around feminism and figure it out.
Mm-hmm. That's quite an astute observation, yes. I had a discussion once with Bonnie Cher Klein, you know, the filmmaker who did Not a Love Story, and she asked me, why don't men want more? She said that was the problem, that men had low expectations and couldn't be brought to projects that entailed more development and more. And I was really surprised because I was into a materialist perspective, and I told her, what? You know, men have everything. Men keep wanting to have more and more. They're always looking at ways of aggrandizing their themselves and their resources and what they get from life and the world. But she was pointing to higher values, of course. She was pointing to something more than having sex with an inflatable doll. Men do these horrible things. You have to wonder, you know, how do you latch on to something else in them so that they will progress to the effort you have to put in if you want to change, if you want to take on the system, you know.
Oh, believe me, I wonder that all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that relates back to the point that you made about male identity. I guess sort of the idea of these sort of higher values, I think they're often really identified as being connected to the feminine, and that a lot of men, I think, are, my feeling anyway, they're afraid to embrace feminism because they're afraid of renouncing their own identity as men. They perceive this loss of what is a really kind of tenuous masculinity by this perceived feminization in terms of identifying with good traits or values that are often associated with women when their sort of identities are constructed in a vacuum or in the negative as what women are not or as differentiating from their mothers or however it is that this masculinity is constructed. It's certainly pretty unstable, and I think that there's a really sort of huge ego threat that comes along with some of even recognizing these things as being higher values and attaching values to these things that they've sort of systematically been taught to devalue in the process of constructing their own identity as a man.
Absolutely, and John Stoltenberg, who's really my mentor, wrote about this in a book called The End of Manhood, in which he tried to point out that the way towards more masculinity was actually putting men in a more tenuous position, because you're never male enough, you're never masculine enough. You always have to, the way femininity is a trap for women, because you're always trying to be better and always in competition and never good or beautiful enough, is the same thing for men. We never have enough power if power is what we identify to. So it's a way of acknowledging that anguish in young men and trying to steer them toward or actually to maintain their empathy, because I think I speak a lot in schools, and I find that young men, especially young men who sort of break from the virility trap early on and that gravitate more towards more sensitive or more socially attuned activities, still have a lot of empathy with the women in their lives. And I find that before they're locked into the masturbating to images of artificial women syndrome, then they can still be touched. They can still emote. You look at the music they listen to. They're really aware of human values before they're driven away from them by the male system. But this is where I part ways with the men's movement. I think the siren song that brings them towards masculinity brings a lot of privilege, brings a lot of power, money, power over women, subservience from other men and from women, children. There are still rewards to masculinity, and seeing men as dupes is a bit losing sight of that. It's a bit convenient for men too.
Mm-hmm. I have something here actually by John Stoltenberg called Why I Stopped Trying to Be a Real Man. Mm-hmm. It's a short article. I just wanted to read a little part of it. We only have a couple of minutes left, so it's going to be kind of quick, and then we'll have a moment to say any kind of closing comments that we want to say.
Wonderful.
So he has on here, "All my life I felt different from other guys. There always were guys who had more manhood than me. Then I read a feminist book that changed my life. It said basically there's no such thing as real men and real women. Gender is a social fiction. That's when I stopped feeling so anxious about whether I measured up against the manhood standard. And that's when I discovered a new kind of personal strength. Over many years, that strength grew as I talked to many guys who had also been raised to believe in manhood, and so they were trying with all their might to be a real man. Everyone I talked to thought there were other men who had more manhood, more than they could ever hope to have." And then later it says, "As I watched guys trying to prove their fantasy of manhood by doing dirt to women, making fun of queers, putting down people of other religions and races, I realized they were doing something really negative to me too, because their fear and hatred of everything non-manly was killing off something in me that I valued. That's why I feel a connection to feminism. I want a humanity that is not measured against the cult of masculinity. I want a selfhood that does not reject fine parts of myself just because they're not manly. I want courage to confront the things men have done in the world that are damaging to women and that are also leaving no safe space for the self I hope to be."
Yeah, so he's quite inspirational.
He has a little bit of reflecting on his own needs as well. But, I guess that's really a part of someone's experience, right, is their own reality. We need to wrap it up. So did you have anything else that you wanted to say, Martin, or anything that you wanted to recommend in terms of authors or places people could go for more information?
Probably the closest women. I think if men listen to women more, especially to their ex-partners, I think we have a lot to learn from women we've been partnered with, either as heterosexuals or simply as life partners or, you know, co-tenants, whatever. If men listen more to women, they move forward a lot more than when they try to wrap their thoughts around the "as a man" meme. You know, that doesn't get us anywhere. "As a man" is about as silly as saying "as a white I feel X or Y." The dominant standpoint is a failed, flawed standpoint. And it's sad that when men start working on their issues, they try to wrap their thoughts around "as a man." I think that's a mistake. Mm-hmm. Reading women has really helped me, and listening to women and loving women has really helped me. And I think that's how men can move forward. But it's not just about men. It's really about the oppressed, the people who are in a dominated situation. And I'm a bit concerned about men bringing, you know, back to themselves. I support non-mixed groups when women choose that, and I don't think men should try to crash women's groups in one guise or another. That's about the kind of things I wanted to talk about. I want to thank you for this program. I think it really helped me get my thoughts together.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Your insights about men are quite accurate, I think.
Well, thank you. We think so. And we thought yours were too. And thanks for talking to us. You have a great day.
Okay.
One
last thing. There's a guy in Vancouver who does great work, Brian Cross. He's done a lot of work in supporting pro-feminist politics, and if men have been listening and want to get involved, I would suggest that they call Rape Relief and get in touch with Brian, because he's quite a resource.
Excellent. Thank you.
He's helped us here in Montreal.
Thank you. That's really useful.
And we'll also be adding some links on our website, www.feminismswithans.ca, and for some resources for other men who are interested in getting more involved in the women's movement and learning more about feminism.
Great.
All right, so you've been listening to The F Word on CFRO 102.7 FM, Vancouver's co-op radio station, and this is Vancouver's only feminist radio show. So join us every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock in the morning here on co-op radio, and you can also listen to live streaming radio of this show on co-opradio.org if you don't get it on your actual radio. And for information on upcoming shows or to listen to past shows, you can go to our website at feminisms.ca. Stay tuned for Red Eye, independent and in-depth programming on culture, politics, and activism. They're on next and every Saturday from 9 until noon. Thanks for listening to The F Word, and have a great weekend.
On me dit que nos vies ne valent pas grand-chose, elles passent en un instant comme fanent les roses. On me dit que le temps qui glisse est un salaud, que de nos chagrins il s'en fait des manteaux. Pourtant quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. Serait-ce possible alors? On dit que le destin se moque bien de nous, qu'il ne nous donne rien et qu'il nous promet tout. Paraît que le bonheur est à portée de main, alors on tend la main et on se retrouve fou. Pourtant quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. Serait-ce possible alors? Serait-ce possible alors? Mais qui est-ce qui m'a dit que toujours tu m'aimais? Je ne me souviens plus, c'était tard dans la nuit. J'entends encore la voix, mais je ne vois plus les traits. Il vous aime, c'est secret, lui dites pas que je vous l'ai dit. Tu vois, quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimais encore. Mais l'a-t-on vraiment dit que tu m'aimais encore? Serait-ce possible alors? Que nos vies ne valent pas grand-chose, elles passent en un instant comme fanent les roses. Me dit que le temps qui glisse est un salaud, que de nos tristesses il s'en fait des manteaux. Pourtant quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. Serait-ce possible alors?